Welcome to Drinking Bros, presented by GhostBed.com. Sit back, relax, and grab a fucking drink.
Welcome to Drinking Bros, kids. We are, 10 hours away from the state of Texas reopening. All of us barefacers will be out into the world. We are celebrating a little heavily today. You're drinking Black Rifle?
Yeah, it is an RTD coffee drink with 300 milligrams of caffeine. So it's like two shots of espresso.
My God, man. They're in every store there is, right?
They are now, yeah.
Good for them. Look at that.
It's good. They also have, so if you get the Starbucks version of this, it is, I think, 38 grams of sugar. And somehow they got it down to 17. I don't know if I believe this or not.
Well, we're making a seltzer, and that's what we're working on as well, and
the
getting that down.
Thing, yeah.
So I understand it, and oddly enough, I know the back end of that, but it's all kind of a big bluff with everything that goes on, and it's smoke and mirrors with all of it. And we have the author of the biggest bluff on the show today, Maria Konnikova. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you guys?
How many times do you get confused for
Anna Konnikova?
Yes.
All the time. And, you know, I don't mind because obviously she's talented, attractive, you know, great to be confused with her. But what I don't get is when people say they're fans of my book and then they quote me and they say by Anna Konnikova. I'm like, guys, come on. It's right in front of you.
I think it's one of those subliminal things like what was the Shazam movie? There was a whole thing on the internet for it. There was a theory about it, how you're calling it the wrong name every single time you think it happened.
The Mandela effect?
That's it. Yes. I think it's like that. I think it's like the Mandela effect, where it's like you have an unusual last name that you don't see that much. Therefore, you've only heard it one time from a famous tennis player and you associate it and you're like, oh, all right. Well, great. That must be the same. No, it's not. It's not the same person.
Nope, not close. Even the same last name.
No.
It's not at all. And you, look.
And you don't even play tennis so far as I can tell. I mean, I don't see any tennis rackets.
I do not play tennis.
No, so.
At all?
No, I mean, I used to play when I was a kid because I'm Russian and, you know, we do that.
Yeah, you do.
It's mostly tennis and cold soups over there.
Yeah, a lot
and
of
chess,
potatoes.
And chess.
Yeah.
And chess.
But
yeah.
I sucked at chess and quit after 1 week. I was a little better at tennis, but never very good.
Yeah. What did you think of The Queen's Gambit? Did you watch it?
I did. You know, it's funny. I really enjoyed watching it and I had issues with a lot of different elements of the show, but it was such an enjoyable watching experience overall that I can't criticize.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It all came together so well.
It was weird. Like all of us were locked into this thing as we all have been throughout COVID, right? I feel like there was moments that were bookmarked by, I mean, specifically Netflix shows. You know, Tiger King started off the pandemic.
It sure did. Yeah. I did not watch that one.
Yeah, okay. But for all of the rest of us, right?
Yes.
The first day of lockdown, it came out that day. And so everybody got caught up in that. And it was a worldwide phenomenon. Right after that, it was The Last Dance, that doc with Michael Jordan.
Yep.
We were all sucked into that. We knew where we were. And then towards the end of it was The Queen's Gambit, where we're like, dude, we're sick of everything. What is this with a female chess player? I mean, it sucked in dudes, you know, which is tough to do. Chess is already difficult because that script had been around in Hollywood for like 15 years. And
yeah,
and then putting a female lead in it who's playing against Russia was like, huh? Well, yeah, we're all in. And I enjoyed the shit out of it.
So did I. So did I. And she did such an amazing job. What a great actress.
Yeah, she's great.
Yeah, I like those stories. I mean, how many, I guess more people know who Marie Curie is now, right, than probably 10 years ago.
Yeah.
Luckily.
I'm sure, yes.
But I doubt many people know that Hedy Lamarr designed the fucking, the general logic behind frequency hopping radios, GPS, the internet at large.
Yeah.
Wrote it on the back of a cocktail napkin and people were like, hey, look, you know, you look great in a dress, but why don't you shut up, honey?
Yeah.
And it stunted our growth technologically for about 25 years.
Yeah.
Because of dude. I guess. I don't know what the fuck you call that. But I like those stories. I like the story of, I can't remember the woman's name, and this fucking proves my point, that worked with Alan Turing on the computer, mm-hmm. the original computer, right? I can't remember her goddamn name.
Well, we have Ada Lovelace.
Yeah, Ada Lovelace is another one, yeah.
Yeah.
It's interesting to me, those things. It, like, if you watch the HBO series John Adams,
mm-hmm.
and it's about John Adams' perspective about the birth of the country, His wife was like his closest confidant, one of the smartest women of all time, had played a huge role in the formation of this country. And nobody knows who the fuck she is, right?
Right.
It's very bizarre.
Yeah.
Like, what? How? I just don't understand.
The stories you choose to tell and why and from what perspective and whatever slant you're going to put on them.
That's why I'm always talking about that book, The Master Switch by Tim Wu. We have this idea from the past. There's a ladybug right there.
Yeah.
We have this idea from the past that the winner gets to rewrite the history book every time. And in ancient Chinese culture, that was absolutely true. Each new emperor that came in pretty much wiped out the old shit and wrote their own history. So we've lost a lot in translation there. Luckily, the Japanese kept good records. But now it's more of, you don't have to wait until your opponent is gone. You can just take control of media, right? And decide who gets to hear what. And it's not new. We like to think like, oh, the liberal media is doing this and that now. No, it's been going on since media has existed.
Yeah, for a very long time. Yeah. And no one would know that better than you. I mean, you started off your career... were you at the New Yorker?
I was. I didn't start off my career at the New Yorker. It took me a while to get to the New Yorker.
Oh, was it like a million other jobs that like nobody talks about in a bio, and then they're like, the New Yorker sounds like a good one to lead off my resume with?
Indeed. I did a lot of freelance work and was a columnist at Scientific American for a while, and was rejected by the New Yorker for many years before I joined them as a writer.
Really? What's the process like for that?
Yeah.
For being rejected?
Well, yeah, yeah,
first
because
you write a piece and you spend a lot of time on it and mm-hmm. you research it and you put your heart into it. Then you submit it to an editor and you get a nice little one sentence note back saying, thank you very much, but this isn't for us. And it's signed. And then you try again and again and again. And meantime, you're publishing these pieces elsewhere mm-hmm. because I was always able to put them somewhere else. And then eventually someone says, oh, this seems like a good idea. And then you have your first byline in the New Yorker. And if it goes well, you keep getting more bylines and eventually they give you a contract.
Now, the reason I ask this is one of the most, interested questions that our audience always sends in of, hey, I want to be a writer. My daughter wants to be a writer. My son wants to be a writer. You're a writer. How do we do it? How do we go from there? I only did screenplays and books. I don't mm-hmm. know the magazine side of it. Do you have to send in essentially like a query letter, like a book, or does your agent submit for you?
No, I mean, I think everyone works a little bit differently, but I personally and all of my writer friends do not work with an agent when it comes to submitting for magazines and newspapers, but you do have to pitch. So you send a pitch. You say, you know, this is my story idea. This is why it's important and timely. This is why I'm the right person to tell it. Whatever it is. And then you hope that you're going to hear back. And at the beginning, you do a lot of cold pitching, which is the same as cold calling, right? Mm-hmm. You just find contact information and try to get things out there. And eventually, once you have a name and a reputation and you've been writing, editors will start to know you and will reach out to you and will say, hey, you know, the story seems like a good fit for you. Are you interested? And that's kind of the goal, to get to that point, that part of your career.
Yeah, it is. And then, you know, starting with the New Yorker, like that, look, I lived in New York, went to NYU after Ohio State. It is a very prestigious magazine. Every rich household on the Upper East Side that I went to for some party or to date some girl, they had a copy of the New Yorker on their coffee table. It was one of those things in New York in particular where it showed a level of wealth. If you had the New Yorker, you were smart, you were well-read, and you were able to have a conversation about things that people don't typically have conversations about. Once you're there at the New Yorker going through all that, mm-hmm. do you really get to say what you want to say and write the pieces you want to write? Or do they pick out pieces for you and say, no, you're going to say this with this type of narrative?
You know, it really depends on who you are and how you write. I always had a lot of my own ideas, and I've never worked on a piece that was assigned to me, but that's quite rare. So I would always
it's very rare.
Pitch a bunch of my own ideas and write what I wanted to write about. And so I was very lucky that I was able to do that. And they definitely don't censor in the sense of, oh, this is how you're going to write it. I think even if they assign a story to you, they're going to assign the topic. They're not going to say, this is how you write it. That's what you work on with the writer and the editor.
You mean at the New Yorker specifically or in media? Because that's certainly not true with the Washington Post. There's been plenty of articles over the last year or so where their executive board has clearly directed people to get away from certain talking points and promote certain talking points.
Same with the New York Times.
Yeah, same with the New York
Times.
I've never
been at either of those institutions, so I can't comment. But at the New Yorker, it's never been like that. But it's a magazine. It's not a newspaper. It's a different thing.
The New Yorker does seem a little cut above those. I mean, to me, the print media from the past, the print newspaper media that's converted into digital media at this point, those are all rags. I don't pay any attention to that shit anymore, to be honest. The New Yorker has historically held itself a little higher in esteem and that doesn't fuck around and dumb shit like that, in my experience anyways. Like, I don't read every single article, obviously, but they don't seem to get caught up in so much of that nonsense, which is nice because there's not a whole lot of that going around. I mean, I can't go to the Washington Post or Fox News and get real information. You know what I mean?
I have to
like pour it in through this filter and shake it and be like, all right, here are the actual facts. And now what the fuck's going on? You know what I mean?
Is that why you didn't want to write for like a Washington Post or a New York Times?
No, it's more my sensibility. I like longer pieces. I like to be able to live with a topic. And so my ideal writing length is book.
Right.
You know, I actually like The Biggest Bluff was my third book, and I like doing that the best. And that's kind of when I get to live in a world for years.
Right,
that's my ideal. And
well, you've come along at a great time then with that attitude, because long form content is king right now.
In particular, audiobooks.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, for sure. Well, I narrated my own audiobook for this book and for the book before. This one I wanted to do myself in particular because it's memoir.
Right.
But the prior one I did as well. And I'm actually working on an Audible original right now. So sweet. I'm definitely, definitely
you've
big into the audio
own,
space.
Right?
You beat me to the question there on that
you've
one.
You've got to read your own.
Yes, yes.
Unless you're saying
this for years.
I can't think of any examples right now, unless you sound like Andy Kaufman doing his weird little character on Taxi, unless you have a weird ass voice. Read your own fucking audiobook, for Christ's sake.
Yes.
I want to hear it from your, like, Matthew McConaughey's book. We had him on 2 months ago, Green Lights, is an amazing book in its own right. So much more amazing that I get to hear him read it to me. It's like I tuck myself in at night and I pull the covers all the way up to my chin.
Yep.
Only my hands are exposed and I'm like this. I'm really comfy. I've got some hot chocolate right there.
Yep.
And I'm listening to Matthew McConaughey with that silky Southern accent.
Yeah.
Rock me to sleep.
There I was, man in a van. Down
rock
the river.
Me to sleep. It's great. And Neil deGrasse Tyson, too, his book. Now, he had some sections where a female, his reasoning was, I don't want to take those jobs away from people. Makes sense to me. But come on, Neil, we want to hear you talk, buddy.
Yes, we want to hear you talk. But it is a high paying gig if you doing it on your own.
It's not high paying if you do it for your own.
No, it's not for your own.
But if the publisher is paying for that other person, when I looked at the quote for that guy, I was like, holy shit.
Can you imagine going to the publisher and be like, hey, if you're going to pay him that, I'll do it for half that. They're like, no, fuck face. That's your book.
Yes.
Fuck out of here.
Yeah. Which is crazy. So, you know, somebody like you, and I hope you don't take offense to this, you seem so unassuming and nice and all that stuff. The book's about poker and you being a poker player.
Well, the book is not about poker. It's about sociology, right?
It is
human beings and how they.
But that's what life is, right? Yeah. It's a giant
poker as life metaphor. Yes,
it is a giant game of poker. This whole life is, and I literally just did a show about this where it's all smoke and mirrors. It's all card tricks and everything else, and it's like the world has become one big poker game where everybody's kind of against each other in all these facets. And you don't know who's telling lies or truths or why or whatever. And then someone has the winning hand. Typically, it's not the little guy. It's the richest or whatever. and that's what your book is about, essentially.
Yeah. So it's funny. We started off with The Queen's Gambit. And in some ways, my book is kind of the poker version, but it's real. It's not fiction. So I went from New Yorker writer who'd never played poker, who didn't, you know, wasn't a fan of the game, didn't watch the game. I literally did not know how many cards were in a card deck, and decided to leave the New Yorker, get one of the best players in the world to coach me and see what I could learn, and ended up going pro, winning an international championship, becoming sponsored by PokerStars. Like, it ended up becoming an entirely new life for a number of years, and that's not something I could have anticipated, and was the reason why the book was delayed by a few years. It was supposed to be out a few years back.
Oh, was it really?
Yeah, well, it was originally I was going to do this for 1 year, right? I was going to go on leave and learn the game and play in the World Series main event and write about it and write about what I'd learned along the way. But one of the things that I started learning was that I wasn't ready to leave. I wasn't ready to start writing about it because I was living it. And right. I ended up falling in love with the game because it was so much more complex and beautiful, so much better of a metaphor for life right. than I could have ever imagined ahead of time because I didn't know anything about it. And to be honest, it probably helped that it ended up that I was good at it.
Making
more money than I made from writing.
You get a little street cred from that too. Do you think, I mean, to me, this sounds like gonzo journalism without the drugs, right?
Yeah, yes.
Unless you did take drugs. Did you take drugs?
Yeah. I did not, but there are, and that's just me. I don't like to fuck with my brain.
Yeah.
But it's actually really big on the poker circuit, especially, I don't know if especially, but certainly with the best players, they all try to mind hack and optimize. And there's a section in my book that people have asked, like, did this really happen? And the answer is yes. When I had made a final table and I couldn't sleep and I ran into this group of really great players, high rollers, everyone would know all their names. And each one of them offered me like their own personal drug of choice for those types of situations. And I was like, wow, you guys are just well calibrated. And I say this with the utmost respect, like they do the research, they read, they figure out kind of which substance to use when and what quantity. It's not for me, but right. I respect it.
You know, just described Dan's entire life, by the way. Yeah.
I hack all the time.
Yeah.
But I don't want to church it up. I mean,
You're never irresponsible. No. Everything is measured. Everything you do is measured. I've never seen you do drugs on a level that it's like, oh, well, Dan's out of control.
No, I mean, life is about purpose, right? If you're doing something with purpose, then you automatically build in schema to understand it and left and right limits in which to operate. That's just how life works, right? But you can't, the problem with a lot of these guys, Rogan's pretty good about curtailing some of this horse shit, but some of these people that are proponents of hedonism like this or a hedonic calendar overlook the fact that the vast majority of people don't have the discipline to do what you're doing. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Yep. And it's irresponsible just to say that shit out loud.
Correct.
In my opinion. Yep. Without also saying, hey, look, here are some of the pitfalls and blah, blah, blah.
Know your limits.
Yeah.
Exactly.
And with poker, now I dabbled in it a little bit, right? Just a tad. When it started to get hot, there was some friends of mine, because we've all got friends who are, I'm a great poker player and I win my neighborhood tournament and blah, 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 right? And then they think, great, man, I'm going to go to Vegas and sit in one of those rooms at the Bellagio where there's 80 tables and I'm going to go all in against these guys and I'm going to beat them because I beat everybody from my neighborhood. And then they get absolutely fucking smashed, right? I sat there for one night and did the just one night of it, more or less for me, out of curiosity.
Yeah.
I'm sure it was probably like your opening nights. And I lost my ass. But it was very slow, very methodical. And all of these, so I won the first hand by bluffing.
Well done.
Well, thank you. But that turned out to be my downfall. When I flipped the cards over to the dealer, one of the cards hit a corner of a chip and then turned. So they saw. Ugh. Yeah. And I didn't
know. Gotta be careful.
Yes. And the other part about it is I can operate on a lot of alcohol. So we were all drinking that night, and one by one, it was like a slow nod where they looked at each other around the table, and over the course of 3 hours, they proceeded to take every last dollar from me at that table.
There's an old quote about that. If you're sitting at a table and you don't know who the sucker is, you're it.
Correct.
Right.
And I was definitely the sucker.
Yeah.
How were you not on your first attempt out, or did you get the professional coach before going into it?
I did get the professional coach before going into it, but I was still a total sucker. I mean, it took me a while to start winning, but I was a little bit more prepared. So I didn't go into my first live game completely just fresh with no knowledge of anything. So we had a kind of a lesson plan. So first, you see all these books. So first we did a lot of reading and Eric Seidel, who was my coach, assigned me kind of books to read and to figure out what the game was because I didn't know anything. And watching videos, I signed up for training sites. Then he made me start playing online. So I live in New York, but I actually reverse commuted to New Jersey every day because online poker is legal in New Jersey, and yep. played online so that I could get in hands, you know, hundreds and thousands of hands in a much faster way than I ever would live. And until I won my first online tournament. So I play tournament poker, mostly not cash. And that's what I focused on. Now I play both, but at the beginning I really focused on tournaments. So until I won my first tournament and started consistently winning and built up my bankroll, he didn't allow me to play live. So once I had a few $1,000s bankroll just for poker, because he wanted me to take this seriously and really approach it like a professional would.
Sure.
Then I was allowed to go to Vegas and only play in small tournaments, you know, like the $30 daily tournaments, not the $100 tournaments that I wanted to play. Mm-hmm. He's like, no, that's way too much money because you're going to be firing a lot of these and not cashing. And that's exactly lesson, what happened. That's it's a huge lesson for bankroll management.
Yeah, for startups, this is a lesson in business. If you read the book Traction or if you read Principles by Ray Dalio or any of these books, they will tell pretty much anybody that's had success in investing as an AC or BC or whatever it is will tell you that if you have too much money in the beginning, you spend your way out of mistakes and you don't learn lessons and you're fucked downstream, right?
Right, right.
So you went through the process the right way. And this is the problem, right, with modern culture. We want everything now, but things don't work that way. So the if you are the bellwether of resurgent gonzo journalism trend, that would be really good for this country, frankly. It'd be good for humanity in general, but certainly for this country who we've – it seems like we're getting a little bit of our patience back because everybody's figured out that most of our leaders and the media are full of shit, right? And it's not even always that they're full of shit. It's that they're trying to distill a massive amount of information down to the lowest common denominator,
which is a headline. Yeah.
Yeah. It's and it turns into clickbait when you add profit motive to it. The system itself intrinsically is almost predatory. You know what I mean? So it's a difficult job. I don't want to completely shit on people for it, but now it seems like long form content is coming back. People have more of an appetite for it, even if it's a 10-part Netflix series that you're going to binge watch over the course of 2 days, or if it's a fucking 3-hour podcast or whatever the case is.
Or the documentary is the only thing I will say of like, hey man, that could have been as a director, I'm like, hey man, that could have been conduced to like 2 hours. I didn't need the 7-part series where the other 4 parts sucked, like Nexium, for example, on HBO. Whatever, man. I could have figured out that homeboy was carving initials into her by episode 2. Like that, we're good on that. But for you, that is a great point. We host a huge sports show as well, and we gamble on it. Sports gambling across the United States has taken off.
It has.
The reason why, like, I know why you had to go to New Jersey is, you know, when you're online, certain states have certain online capabilities for different gambling. We're going through that now with sports gambling, where betting on live games, I think you can only do it in 6 states right now. However, the Supreme Court has approved it for all 50. It will get there eventually, but it's up to each state's regulations and rules and when they're going to pass that and allow it. But knowing that, I'm surprised that you didn't go to like AC or something like that. Were they not doing it in Atlantic City?
No, they were. I mean, they were playing live poker, but my coach, Eric, is from Vegas. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of his home base. And there are many more games going on in Vegas than in AC. And so I just relocated to Vegas for a few months so that I could play every single day and get volume in.
Yeah.
So that was the, and I've played in AC since then. So it's not like I reject it. I think it's wonderful. The Borgata has great tournaments. But for kind of this initial learning experience, it was better to be somewhere where there's basically a tournament going on anytime, day or night, any day of the week.
Literally, you can find one at 3 a.m. You can find one at 6 p.m, noon, lunchtime.
There's one that starts at 9 a.m. for the people who never went to sleep, or the ones like me who are, you know, journalists and wake up and say, ooh, 9 a.m, let's go play a tournament. But I ended up being in Vegas for like the first month. I couldn't cash for the life of me. And it felt like all of the studying I was doing, all of these things I was learning, like it was pointless because I just kept busting. And for people who don't know what tournament poker is like, it's not like a cash game. You pay your entry fee, but then most people go home with zero.
Yeah.
It's not like you can get up at any point in time and cash out. Your chips have no cash value. So normally about anywhere from 10 to 15% of the field get paid and everyone else makes zero. And so those $30 tournaments were adding up really quickly. And I was like down a grand. I was like, holy shit, what is even happening? And I came very close a few times, called bubbling. When you bubble a tournament, it means that you're the last person to get zero and the next person who is out actually makes money. But I still remember my first tournament cash. I won a Planet Hollywood tournament for a little over $900. And it was like the greatest moment.
I thought you were going to say a Planet Hollywood t-shirt. I'm like, fuck yeah.
No. Yeah.
You
yeah.
can't even find those goddamn things anymore.
Did you stay in the Planet Hollywood?
No, no. I actually stayed at the Aria, which is where Eric played.
Mm. Oh, okay.
That's where the Aria hosts all the high rollers.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they are very nice to poker players.
That's yeah. great. At any point, did you consider quitting? Because after you keep yeah. losing enough, and this is what happened to some friends of mine. I have a little bit of knowledge into that poker world. Again, the ones who thought they were really good and flying out to Vegas all the time to go to the tournaments and everything else. Finally, you know, 3-4 months in, they realize I'm not good enough for this. And I am just a neighborhood poker player who is probably better than all my friends, but not even close to this professional level. Was there a moment where you were like, I'm going to quit and just get the fuck out of here?
There were definitely times when I came close to quitting. And the reason I didn't was because, as you keep calling it, it was gonzo journalism. And there was a little third person me sitting on my shoulder saying, hey, you know, it doesn't matter if you're winning or losing. This is good material. You're learning really important lessons for life. And I was really lucky because Eric stressed to me that it's never about the outcome as long as you're thinking well. Right? It's not about whether you won or you lost. It's about, did I think through this correctly? Did I make the right decision? And if the answer is yes, keep going and eventually you'll start winning. And so that was very helpful. But I think the moments that I came closest to quitting, it wasn't just because I was losing. It's also because it's tough when 98% of the world is male and you're the only woman at the table. And a lot of times guys aren't used to playing with females. And I definitely had to go through a little bit of abuse at the poker tables.
When you say abuse, what do you mean? And part two of that.
I've been called everything. I mean, every word you can think of, you know, bitch, cunt, whatever. I've been called to my face.
Right.
Especially when I'm winning. Actually, that started happening more when I started taking people's money.
Yeah.
But the
guys are not speaking to one another that way, you think?
No, not at all.
Because I call everybody cunts. I pause before I call a woman one. Because it seems weird to me, but dudes I call cunts all the time.
No, this was directed at me. I've been propositioned at a poker table, like actually given a room key and told what my rate would be. You know, like,
was
kind
it
of
high money. Was it a good number?
Well, it was a 5K tournament, and the guy told me not to worry about the entry fee because he'd be willing to front the next one.
That's not a bad trade.
That says a lot about how hot you are, at least. Yeah. Like, and that's a fun thing, at least.
It's like, but I would always just, you know, I would always sit back and say, you know what, this is great material for the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and it all made it into the book.
Yeah,
and it's character building.
Yeah,
and like, holy shit, I can outplay these guys if that's what they're thinking.
Yes,
then I can take advantage of
that.
That was
part two of my question. Is it an advantage? And it seems like it probably is.
Yeah,
right?
It ended up being. At first, it wasn't because I was not very good at poker. I was too timid. I didn't have any confidence. I was totally out of my element. Mm. But once I actually started realizing what was going on and having kind of that metacognitive awareness of myself, it became, like I said, a total superpower because I could figure out, it became kind of this game of, okay, what do you think of me? What do you think of women? How do you think a girl plays poker? Because that's what you're thinking. Once I figure that out, I can completely exploit it.
Right.
And when you look at a guy at a table, you just think poker player. When you look at me, you think female.
Right.
And not poker player.
You know,
because that's what stands out about me.
Yeah. And it's interesting you say that, because that one night when I was talking about at the Bellagio that I got into, that there was only one woman in that entire room, and she lost pretty quickly. And dude, the table just fucking erupted. I mean, they were like, dude, you believe this girl? Fuck this girl, blah, 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 blah. I mean, it was relentless.
But why would that, or finish your story.
Yeah, no, but it was relentless. And I guess, because I had asked somebody else, I go, is that unusual? And they were like, yeah, man, no women play. And this was before the televised tournaments, right? Mm-hmm. So I think when it got to television, you were starting to see more and more women play, so it became more commonplace. But before, because this is before it was televised, and dude, that chick was the only girl in the entire room, and she got slaughtered when she got out. And it was.
But yeah. That doesn't make any sense to me. If it were a fucking wrestling match or a basketball game, and a woman tried to play with men, I'd be like, that's probably not a great idea. But this is not. Why would a woman not be good at this? This seems like something a woman would actually be better at.
Well, I have a theory on it, and I'm glad you asked that, because I was trying to think about it as well. When you go into these things, and
some of it is this garden variety misogyny. That's probably most of it. And dudes don't want to feel like they're going to get beat by a woman sometimes, which is fucking stupid.
Right.
Like, are we going to have a contest to see who can give birth better to, motherfucker? I mean, what are we doing here exactly?
but that's stupid. So here's my theory, and you can tell me if I'm correct in this, because you've played in a bunch of tournaments at this point, okay? Yeah. When you go to these things, especially late at night, or, you know, that's when a lot of these are, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And you play into the early hours of the morning. What I found from the dude perspective was that most of these guys didn't sleep. They didn't shower. They stunk. They were weird. They had strange personal habits to themselves. So this woman happened to be attractive who played. It was completely foreign to them. And they just did not know how to react to whatever. Some of it I felt like was out of like shock that they were like, oh, well, this woman's in the tournament, and they didn't know how to treat her because these guys clearly hadn't showered in days. Yeah. The only women that were in the actual room that night during this late night game at the Bellagio, and there was a lot of people in there, were actually masseuses. So they have these masseuses that you could pay for to physically massage you throughout however many games of poker you can play. And those were the only women in there. And I think that's just all they were used to.
Maybe. I mean, there probably is some level of social awkwardness involved. But it kind of reminds me, it's honestly kind of pathetic, because it reminds me of those fat neck beards living in their parents' basement watching Miss Universe or whatever. And they're like, ugh, they're eating like fucking Cheetos.
You just described every male poker player.
With orange stains down their chest because they don't have a fucking napkin to wipe their hands on. And they're like, oh, her nose is kind of big, man.
It's very similar.
Yeah, like, get the fuck out of here. Are you out of your mind?
Well, you know, from your perspective, do you ever see attractive dudes rolling there? And you're like, oh, man, that's crazy. He doesn't look like he fits here. Like, there's usually a type. It's a tracksuit. It's a gold chain. The headphone thing is huge now too. Well, they're all in headphones and sunglasses.
Wow. What's her name? Kim Kardashian showed up to a tournament. She had mirrored sunglasses on, which is probably not a good idea.
No,
to hold
not
a mirror
a good idea.
Up with your fucking cards in front of you. But hey, what do I know?
She was out very quickly.
I'm not a
night.
Scientist.
Yeah.
Yeah. But the whole premise around that is it's gotta be, maybe there's some level of social awkwardness, but I really think it's probably just garden variety dude bullshit. Right.
Yeah,
I think it's a combination.
Yeah, of both. But when you start winning, though, that's got to feel good. Where you're like, oh,
it feels amazing.
Because it also puts more pressure on them, because this is supposed to be their world, right? And then here's this girl coming in and taking all their money. And a lot of these people know each other.
Yeah, well, it's funny that you say that, because I actually got a lot of shit and a lot more hatred when I started winning, especially after I started becoming better known, like after I won my first major international tournament, which was a big, it was a big deal, and got sponsored, and people were like, you don't deserve this. You haven't been playing long enough. You didn't earn it. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, I've been working my ass off, and I won this fair and square. You know, it's not like I didn't do anything weird, but they have this feeling of like, oh, you don't deserve it if you haven't been playing your whole life. And
right.
if
that's
you're,
like that new money versus old money debate, right?
Yeah,
like the old Vanderbilts don't like the like new tech billionaires because you just got your money. Like, what the fuck does that mean, bitch?
Yeah.
Exactly. But I will say that there is a difference between like the vast majority of poker players and then the elite, right? So people like my coach, like Eric, and all of the super high roller players, they are super nice and smart and gracious, and they had my back. Like, not only did they never give me shit, but like they protected me and made sure that everyone was treating me well. And when they saw someone not treating me well, they would stand up for me.
That's good.
Which was great. So having that protection and seeing what was possible really helped inspire me and realize that that's possible too, right? It's not all those guys with the Cheeto stains down their front.
Yeah. It's close. Have you ever played with those guys? Have you ever played with like Phil Hellmuth or Ivy and those
Daniel
guys?
Daniel Negreanu. Yeah. How do you say his name? I can't say
Daniel Negreanu. Yeah, Negreanu. I've played with both Daniel and Phil. I've never actually played with Phil Ivey.
Okay,
I like Negreanu. I actually watched his masterclass. It's pretty interesting. But it is the same as any other fucking form of competition. It's basically game theory, right? That's displayed in a different kind of way. And you're learning about human beings. It's like one of my favorite books of all time. I'm not a religious person at all, but one of my favorite books is called The Screwtape Letters by C.S. Mm-hmm. Lewis.
That's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it is really good. If you haven't read it, even if you're not religious, I would read it because the basic premise is Screwtape is a demon in hell. He's writing letters to his nephew on earth, trying to train him on how to trick human beings into going to hell, basically, mm-hmm. right? But it's just a treatise on human sociology or psychology.
It is great. I mean, it's really good. It's a great book.
Yeah.
Yep.
One of my favorites.
Yeah, mm-hmm. and when I was talking about poker being a metaphor for life, it is. It really is in every single facet, business in particular, the business world and everything else. What's the highest amount of money you've won from a tournament?
Let's see, that would have been the PCA one, 120 something thousand in total.
Holy shit. Like so at that point, do you look at writing as a hobby and this more of your profession? I mean, I know writers get paid.
For while I was doing this, I really wanted to take it seriously. So I did do it really full time. Like I studied, I played, I traveled the world. So the year where I was really seriously playing, I was on the road for 8 months out of the year, just to give you a sense of like how seriously I was taking it. But no, I mean, I love writing. It's who I am. And so at this point, I think I have no plans to quit poker, but I also have no plans to quit writing. So the good thing is you can write from anywhere in the world. And I think the two things are very compatible. Of course, live poker basically died over the last year because of COVID. Mm-hmm. And so I've taken a step back and the last year has been all about writing, but I'm definitely looking forward to playing again once people get vaccinated and those big series start going again.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I find it interesting that you started online and then you're like live, but you won't go back to online?
I mean, I can't play online in New York. It's not legal here. So there's no regulated poker in New York. So I have to go somewhere else, but I don't like playing online nearly as much as I like playing live. And to be perfectly honest, I'm not as good at it because I have a psychology background. So one of my edges is in people and dynamics and kind of understanding the table. And that's something that I lose.
Yeah. If your superpower was probabilistic theory, then that would be a whole, you could probably play online and have the same amount of success. But if you're watching hand movements and that's how you determine body, because that's what I watch in an interrogation when I was in the military. If I'm fucking somebody up, I'm watching their hands because hands betray everything. Touching your face.
I love that you said that. I have a whole section of the book because I worked with people who were looking at tells and who actually studied tells in the poker table. And it turns out that all the tells are in the hands.
Mostly,
and the face, the poker face, I mean, most of the tells. And the poker face is kind of bullshit because our faces don't give away that much because everyone knows they're supposed to keep a poker face. And that's what everyone is focusing on.
There are micro expressions that are helpful. Yes. But I mean, even then, a micro expression, you don't know what they mean necessarily. And also a micro expression can be caused by physical stimulus.
Yeah.
Whereas a hand, the hand thing, it's very unlikely that I'm going to reach to my face and just touch it briefly. If it's itching, I'm going to do this.
Sure.
Right. Or if there's something on it, I'm going to wipe it off. But if I ask you a question, you're like, I don't know, man, it's like not a big deal. It's a big deal because I did that, frankly. Mm. That is 99% of the time that's true. I mean, that's...
Yeah. I love that. I love that you said that because that's what all the research into tells in poker and lying shows as well. So it's very cool. So I lose all of that when I'm playing online.
So if anybody's dating you, probably don't lie to you is what you're saying. Not in person anyways. Over text, it'll be fine. You can tell all your lies through text, but not just not in person. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah.
Because you're going to pick up on it.
Nobody can lie to me. No, that's not true.
I think the reason I lost is because my face was like this at the table. And I knew, like, they knew, like, oh.
Oh, my God. I remember, look, despite the fact that I was playing online and, like, I was getting this wonderful coaching, I remember the first time I had pocket aces in a live setting, my hands started shaking. And I was like, shit, stop shaking. And you, why are you shaking?
And you couldn't stop it.
Yeah, there's no stopping it. Once it starts, there's no stopping that shit.
Did they know? Did everybody
Of course
just
they fucking knew.
Of
course they knew. Everyone folded. Yeah. You don't even have to be good at reading people to spot something like that.
No. That's really funny, though, because everybody, if you're sitting at a good table, everybody's a professional. And for the most part, like, I would assume a lot of the harassment you got was on the come up and not at the pinnacle.
Yes, yeah. That is correct.
You know, I assume it's the same in every organization. You're going to find shitheads at the top of any industry, whatever it is. But most of the viper bullshit happens in the mid levels. It's people who are trying to step on each other to get somewhere else. It doesn't really play well with Nash's equilibrium theory, to be honest. I really would recommend people dip into that a little bit. And I mean, shit, even without knowing it, McConaughey talks about it in Green Lights a little bit about how being selfish sometimes can be a form of being selfless, right? Mm-hmm. If you go after the best thing, but never to the detriment of other people.
Yeah. Right.
That's kind of that is a very reductive view of Nash equilibrium theory. But it is important to do that, right? If you're be responsible, be one of those guys that says, hey, I see that these people are fucking with you. Yeah. I'm not going to let that fucking happen anymore. Yeah. Not in my presence, right? I say that
exactly.
All the time.
I think that that's so important. And I think that too many people, you know, they don't think long term. Mm. And poker, yeah, sure. Any hand of poker, any game is zero sum. You know, I win, you lose, you win, I lose. But in the long run, I mean, it's a positive something because there's an ecosystem and it's repeated interaction and you see the same people and you're playing with the same people. And being an asshole does not pay because literally you're not going to get invited to the good games if you play cash.
Right.
You know, it literally doesn't pay. And I think there's actually a lot to be said for stepping up, being nice, stepping in when you see something's going wrong, because then that person will come back. And at that point, you know, if you stepped in for me, you know, 2 years ago, I'm a total fish. You want me in the game. You can take my money. So be nice to me.
Yeah, there's also something to be said for the back end of that, where we've become very comfortable in our personal lives and business, but mostly in politics, with dancing on the graves of our opponents. Anytime there's a point to be made, we make that point and then celebrate that point as if it contributed somehow.
Right.
Like, yeah, we fucking got them this time. What exactly did you get, motherfucker?
You got
nothing. People become more deeply entrenched because they feel attacked and no progress is made. You stupid son of a bitch.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are we doing here? This is all really fucking basic human psychology, by the way.
It is.
Yeah, but I would have to imagine with somebody like you, like, I'm going through your bio here, NYU School of Journalism, graduated from Harvard, received your PhD in psychology from Columbia. These are the most prestigious universities that our nation has to offer. The guys that you're going up against typically don't have a background like yours. Did you ever say that out loud at a table and let them know it? Or did they find out about it later and say, oh shit, we can't fuck with her now? Because, I mean, that's crazy. Yeah. A PhD in psychology from Columbia is a boss move. Like, did you ever say that to somebody?
No, I did not. One of my great assets is something that I lost as I became more well-known, which was my anonymity. No one had any clue who I was. I was just, you know, another girl. And that was nice because I was routinely completely underestimated and they had no idea. And I would never say that because why would I? It's more information. You want to give as little information as possible and you want to try to get other people to give you as much information as possible because, you know, life's a game of information and the person with the informational advantage has the advantage.
Yeah.
So that's always my strategy. But then yes, it's very funny that you say that did someone figure it out after the fact?
Yeah.
So there was a very funny, once I started playing bigger tournaments and doing well and being on televised tables and was kind of an ambassador for the game, I felt like, you know, I have to talk and be friendly and make a good televised table, right? Actually, like, make it engaging for the people watching.
Because it is entertainment. It is entertainment.
Yes, exactly. It is entertainment at that point. Yeah. And there was this guy who just wouldn't engage with me. He was just sitting there and he wouldn't talk. And he just was staring in front of him. And I was like, oh my God, what did I ever do to this guy? And at some point he looks at me and he says, I'm really sorry. Can you please stop talking to me? You seem really nice, but my girlfriend told me I couldn't talk to you because you have a PhD in psychology and you're going to rape me. I was like, that's very, very funny.
That is so funny.
So sometimes people would, once they found out, they would not necessarily want to engage. But at the, then there came a point where people knew who I was. And that's fine too. I mean, you know, you adapt.
And then you can also use that to your advantage too.
Yeah,
like,
for
all right,
sure.
Great. Going in, I'm that woman who's got the PhD in psychology.
Let me try to psych you out.
Exactly.
Well, I mean, it works. I think of it like physics, right? So if I know the laws of physics, then I can throw an object and predict how it's going to bounce off the wall, for example, right?
Mm-hmm.
If I know what you're thinking, then I can send stimulus in your direction and I know how you're probably going to react to it more times out of not. And as a professional gambler, at least if as a professional sports gambler, which is what we do, if you're right 58 to 62% of the time, you're considered a professional.
Yes.
That's very good, right?
So yeah, that's great.
Yeah. So I mean, and
most people lose their shirt in sports betting.
We
do very, very well. I mean,
I was gonna say that's good for us because
it is
somebody's gotta lose, right?
Shit. So,
yeah.
And it's not gonna be the house. That's never gonna happen.
But I will say this, at least I'm not going up against somebody else, right? I'm just going against in our case, MyBookie,
right,
is one of our sponsors, MyBookie.com. I don't know if you've played poker on there or any of their stuff there, but they were international, so you can go anywhere on that platform.
Cool. Yeah.
And
you can also use a VPN to mask your location, and New York can get fucked, frankly, because why would they have a say in what I do in my house?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Motherfucker.
Yeah.
Like,
you can bet on sports in New York.
Oh, listen, don't get me wrong. I am the most vocal about legalizing online poker
everywhere
because it's such bullshit. I mean, you have a fucking lottery. The lottery, now that's cruel.
Yeah.
And that targets vulnerable people. Yeah. That's awful. And you use it for revenue for the state. And you say that online poker is gambling? Like, give me a break.
Yeah,
sorry.
The lottery is basically, I don't remember who said it, but it's like a welfare buyback program, basically.
Yeah, I mean, it's a tax on the poor.
Yeah,
it's a tax on the people who are least equipped to understand it. And that's gambling, pure and simple. I mean, that's a lottery. And poker is a skill game, you know, just like sports betting. Mm-hmm. At the end of the day, you know, you can have a skill edge.
Look,
legitimately, you can make money over time.
And our skill edge, and we've said this on the show before, because of we own a ticketing company as well, we're able to get field passes. When we go down and see these players in real life, in particular college, not so much the NFL. The NFL is a professional game where most of the players are the same size, speed, everything else. But in these college games, there is a world of difference against the top tier athletes
and
on that field versus their opponents.
You're also dealing with, on average, for a normal regular season game, a 15 to 35 point spread.
Yep.
That is a lot. That's a huge fucking delta in your gambling, mm-hmm. right? I mean, that's not like a binary one or zero. That is like, not only are they going to win the game, but are they going to win by four fucking touchdowns? What's the impetus for that? You have to start thinking about what about 2 weeks from now when they're playing this other team? Do they want to not risk injury late in the fourth quarter so they're not going to get those extra touchdowns and the other team is going to get a garbage touchdown and fuck that whole thing up? There's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
So being able to see it in person is very fucking beneficial.
Very beneficial. There was one game that him and I were covering. I'll never forget. It was Clemson, NC State.
Oh, yeah.
Trevor Lawrence is their quarterback. He's going to go number one in the draft this year, the NFL draft here in a couple months. And that was the first time we got to see him in person. The spread on that game, I think, was 28.5.
Yeah, and he scored 35 in the first quarter.
And as soon as I saw, because we were down there, as soon as I was standing next to him and how big he was in real life, I thought, I'm a big dude. I'm 6'3.5", about 225. And he was towering over me and just absolutely shredded, right? Yeah. And I was like, oh my God. And I looked at the other team.
He looked like a man amongst children out there.
He was a full head above everybody else. And I was like, they're going to smash him. I was able to go on my phone before the game started, bet it. And sure enough, yes, we blew out that cover and it was amazing. But there is a definite live element to it that is a big, big advantage. So I completely understand that. Now here it says your winnings have tallied now over $300,000. Is that true?
That is true.
Holy shit. What'd you do with it, if you don't mind me asking?
She paid 60% of it to the state of New York.
Yeah, for taxes. That's
actually correct. Most people, when I say 60%, they're like, ha ha, very funny. I'm like, 60%. No, actually, that's what you pay for them. Yep. 60% went to New York, and then I wasn't writing. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, yeah, for sure. So it was living expenses and travel for poker. I mean, it's, you know, it's not all profit either, because all the tournaments that I entered fees, that I didn't cash aren't on there.
Right.
Right. And it's all about risk management too. So talk about business analogies. You don't, it's not just bankroll management where you make sure that you're not playing with too much of your bankroll, but then how do you manage your risk? So I would sell pieces of my action. So I had, you know, what you see on the Hendon Mob, you know, me winning over 300,000. I didn't actually get all of that because there was someone, you know, someone would have 10%.
Right.
And the way that it works is if you don't win anything, they pay you 10%. So it helps mitigate the costs and all of that.
Right.
But then if you win, they get 10%. So
and these are people footing the fee or a sponsorship, like you're wearing their brand during the tournament or whatever.
No, these are just individuals. So like, for instance, if the two of you talk to me and you're like, you know, we think Maria has a real edge over this field. Maria, can we buy 5% of your action? I would say sure. And so if it was a, you know, $10,000 tournament, get 5% of it, and so you give me that money and I use it for the entry fee. And then if I don't win, then you guys just lost it. It was you bet on me and I lost for you. But if I make money, then you get 10%.
Are most
you make money back.
Yeah.
Are most of these tournaments winner take all, or are there like a tiered structure of payouts, or how does that work? Because I'm not really
tiered structure.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
So, but it's always top heavy.
Of course. So, right. I mean, you want it to be. Because you want that final table to be fucking nuts, right?
Exactly. That's what it always is. So if you're the kind of person who always min caches, this was a huge lesson I had to learn, because I used to get very, very cautious right when we were near the bubble, the money bubble, because I wanted to cash.
Yeah.
And people who are professionals will mercilessly take advantage of that, because that's not the point. You're going to lose money if you keep min caching, because the expenses of traveling and of playing outweigh, you know, whatever you make, $100 or whatever it is. So you really have to go for the win. You have to go for the top. And so your strategy has to be much more aggressive. And so you take advantage of people like me, or the player I was before I realized this or was taught this. And you take advantage of the fact that they just want to cash. They want that score. And so you bluff them and you are aggressive, because they're going to fold everything because they don't want to be the last person out right before the money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, Maria, you're an interesting person, because your life, like I'm just going through it. How many books have you actually written? I know two of them have been New York Times bestsellers, correct?
I've written three, and all three have been New York Times bestsellers.
Oh, look at that. Nothing like getting corrected live on air. I love that. I do that to people all the time. That's great. Tell Amazon to change your profile. They still got you listed at two. They still got you listed at two underneath the Amazon authors there.
Sorry about that.
No, that's Amazon's fault. They don't give a shit. Are you kidding me? But all of these books are, it's completely different. Was that on purpose, or?
I just write about what I'm interested in. And, you know, if you look in retrospect, I think there's some sort of arc there. Like my first book was about Sherlock Holmes and how to think better and think more clearly. And it was really about mindfulness and paying attention and being present. And the fact that the reason that Sherlock Holmes was so good at being a detective was because he was so good at mindfulness. So that was kind of, you know, the nice detective element of the world. My second book was about con artists, and I spent multiple years with con artists and their victims, learning, you know, how people con and scam each other.
Like Deanne Warwick and shit?
Yeah, yeah.
I think she's probably dead by then, but.
No, she's alive.
Oh, is she alive?
She's still alive.
She's on Twitter. She's at,
she's like, she's like a Twitter celebrity.
Yes. Oh, whenever she tweets, it trends.
So it's like Rex Chapman, these people that were complete pieces of shit during their entire lives, and now all of a sudden they're fucking Twitter cool.
Yeah, it's
like,
weird,
you fucking
man.
Kidding me, dude?
So Twitter's a weird
one. OJ's on Twitter too.
Yeah, yeah. So. And he got vaccinated for everybody else.
Good for him.
So it's going to the right people, which is important. Why Sherlock Holmes?
What do you mean, why Sherlock Holmes? You don't like Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, motherfucker? You don't like deductive reasoning?
What's
your problem, asshole?
I do, but like, there's been a lot of, no offense.
He doesn't
been
like
a lot
Benedict Cumberbatch. That's his problem.
Well, I hate Cumberbatch. I've never been a Batch
fan.
This
was pre-Cumberbatch, so this book was before Sherlock.
But there's been a lot of takes on Sherlock Holmes. Yeah. Why did you decide to do it?
But there wasn't any take on the psychology of Sherlock Holmes. And it was an accident in the sense that I was I was asked to do a piece about mindfulness. And this was before mindfulness was a catchphrase, like no one knew what it was. And so I was trying to figure out, you know, how do I explain this? And the image that came to mind was from one of the Sherlock Holmes stories. So when I was a little kid, my dad would read out loud to us, to all lots of brothers and sisters. There were four of us and we would all have Sunday night reading, and he read the Sherlock Holmes stories to us when I was little. And so, you know, childhood memory is very powerful. They kind of stick. And so there was this one scene that I really remembered well. And it was when Holmes asks Watson how many steps lead up to 221B Baker Street, and Watson doesn't know. And I just, when I was a kid, I was just totally shocked by this. I made my dad stop reading so that I could count the number of stairs that led up to kind of our front door and like from first floor to second, because I was a little confused about, you know, fictional characters. So I wanted to make sure that when Sherlock Holmes asked me, I'd know the right number of stairs, but obviously missed the point totally when I was a kid. But now as an adult, when I was writing this piece about mindfulness, I remember that scene and I was like, wait, that's mindfulness, right? Because what Holmes says is the difference between us is you only see, I both see and observe. And that's mindlessness versus mindfulness. And so I wrote this piece and it ended up being the most successful thing I'd ever written. And so I decided to reread the Holmes stories because I hadn't ever read them as an adult. And I was like, holy shit, this is a gold mine. Like, this is such a beautiful map of the human mind and human psychology. And I wrote a few more columns about Holmes and they did well and they sold the book.
That's cool. Yeah. I mean, that's kind of an analog for modern society with smart technology, right? So, Neil said it last week on the show, he called himself Tyson. Should say that too?
We had Neil deGrasse Tyson on the show last week, and he called himself Tyson, which was a baller move.
We made fun of him. We made fun of him a little bit for that, but it's fine.
Should I be calling myself Konnikova? Is that kind of?
I think so.
I would think about it.
Just go straight mononym, but don't go Sting.
You can't go like Edge or like a one-word thing.
Well, the Edge is technically two words. Not even technically, it is two words.
Yeah,
I get you. No, it's. he said this phrase that he said quite a bit before: we have smartphones and dumb people, right? So we have more access to information than ever right now, but we're not smarter in any way for it. As a matter of fact, we're dumber probably for it, because we've condensed what it feels like to know something into sound bites, and that's just not, I mean, your work is proof that is not good, right? I mean, it's certainly not good for the national discourse, because the second and third order, the second order effect of that is immediate. It doesn't take any time at all. And what it is you build a schema or an archetype for whomever the out group is, the other, right? So if I am a liberal and I go onto Fox News and I read the headlines, I think that most people who identify or whatever the fuck is conservative just believe the headlines of Fox News. And maybe that's true, maybe it's not. But you can't confirm that by simply reading Fox News. You have to talk to human beings.
Yeah.
And then typically through that conversation, there are levels of nuance where you're like, oh, shit, you don't think any of that stupid shit, right? And vice versa with the fucking liberal media as well. So we are dumb as fuck is the point of all that. Just in general as a culture, we've tried to get somewhere faster than we were intended to get there. Mm-hmm. And we are now suffering the consequences of that on a daily basis.
Right. Yeah, and you know, with the con artist book, did you actually hang out with like real con artists and all that stuff?
I did. Yeah, I did some of my interviews in prison. Some of them had been caught.
Oh, that's dope. Did you get like Jordan Belfort, anybody like that?
No, I did not talk to Jordan. But I tried to do people who were not very well known, so that it would be like I didn't go for Bernie Madoff, but I went for less well-known Ponzi schemers.
Right.
And the original Ponzi schemer, who was not Ponzi, who was pre-Ponzi.
Was he pissed about that?
Well, he's dead.
That he didn't get the credit he deserved, Ponzi, you know?
Oh, yeah.
As if you create a scheme like that, you
mean the original?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Franklin? No, I don't think so. I mean, he went to jail, too. Yeah. And then he eventually got out of jail. People believed in him until the end. Mm. I mean, brilliant scamster.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Even the guy from NXIVM, what I was talking about earlier, like, dude, there was girls that came out at the end of that trial and they were like, no, I was in.
Oh, my God.
And
that is one of the things that I found over and over and over, that the victims of con artists, even after the con was exposed, so often just kept believing in it. That's how much you buy into it. And they're like, no, there's a total explanation for this. No, this isn't really a con. This was a conspiracy. And right, they come up with all of these reasons why they weren't conned. And I actually did the last chapter of that book was kind of the ultimate con, the cults. Mm. And I did not talk to any cult leaders, but I did talk to some people who were professional cult exfiltrators.
Right, yeah.
So they basically joined cults and figured out how to get in so that they could get someone out. So they were hired by victims' families and figured out how to get them out of that situation, which is pretty damn cool.
Yeah, that is actually cool.
And it also proves that there is a job out there for anyone. You know,
yep.
If I had to go into a sex cult and get somebody out of there, it would be a conversation that I had with my wife. But if they were paying enough money, obviously I would have to do it.
Well, look,
that's the world.
The bad news for you is that sex cults very rarely benefit the male initiates, right? I mean, it's mostly for the leader.
Right.
So you're basically getting cucked the whole time.
Yes, that's how
that works. Yes. Which is, you know, if that's your thing, then God bless. But
yeah, my wife is super into that. She was talking about Jim Jones.
She's super
and those
into
guys,
getting cucked.
She was like, you know, he was fucking dudes too, right? And I was like, no. Why? And it was more of a dominance thing. And I was like, all right, well, shit.
Well, I understand that. From a dominance perspective, sure.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Sometimes you got to do it. Now, what you're describing is essentially cognitive dissonance, right? I mean, it's one of the tiers, I suppose, of post-traumatic stress, along with catastrophizing and emotional reasoning and things like that. But, it is an assault on the psyche to be exposed or to have something you truly believe in be exposed as fake. People find out things they believed about. Like if aliens showed up here right now, there are a lot of religious people that would lose their fucking minds because they would have no context. Like, how does this fit into my worldview? And every time, look, that's the reason the church fought back so hard against the sun being the center of the solar system, for example, right? Like, no, the earth, man. We're important. The earth.
And
they literally exiled and imprisoned and killed people for saying otherwise. Like, are you fucking serious? That's how it works, right? People, it triggers some, I don't know if it's the stellate ganglia, it's some part of the fight or flight mechanism to hear information that challenges your worldview. And look, it is on full fucking display right now. No matter which side of the political aisle you fall on, whether you believe in masks or don't, I don't know why you wouldn't believe that a mask blocks water coming out of your face. The point is who's susceptible to it and who's not, and how we handle the economic situation. That's the real debate. But anyways, the left versus right thing, like all of my super liberal friends right now are incredulous about Biden's handling of the immigration system so far. The cages are still open and blah, blah, blah. Not only are they open, but they've expanded and shit like that. Still no stimulus shit and blah, 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 blah. All the stuff, all the hypocrisy in politics. Politicians are full of shit anyways, but
indeed.
I have a brand. It's called All Politicians Are Cunts, right?
Yeah. He calls it APAC.
APAC, yeah, which is better than CPAC, by the way.
Correct.
CPAC can get fucked. At any rate, people, you challenge their worldview, and I think it's the problem with what it means to know something. We these in out group things that are going on right now, and the Weinstein brothers do get a bit of talking on this subject, as does Douglas Murray. But the in out group thing, where I have to subscribe to points, you know, 1 through 7 on this side or 1 through 7 on this side, and that's how I identify. But it is like the ultimate form of social confirmation bias, where, well, if you don't believe all 7 of these things, you're not a fucking conservative. You're a fucking rhino, man. Fuck you. Like, do I have to believe everything you believe? What exactly are we going for right here? You know what I mean? It's wild. No, I
couldn't agree more. I mean, I'm someone who has argued for as long as I can remember, at least since high school. I wrote a paper on it against partisanship, like against the partisan model, because it blocks people from having to think, right? Just think through the fucking issues. Yeah. What do you think about this? What do you think about that? Like, mix and match, figure out what you actually believe in, and then figure out who you support based on kind of the things that are important to you. Don't do it because you're a Republican or a Democrat and your ticket says, I mean, that's mindlessness, right? Yeah. That's kind of it completely undercuts critical thinking.
Right.
And I'm against very strong partisanship, whether it's political or religious or anything. As soon as you have kind of this mindset of, you know, evangelical, like, this is what I am and this defines me, that's the moment your mind just completely closes off to critical thinking. And that's when cognitive dissonance is going to operate, where your dissonance reduction is going to be so strong that you're going to just be willing to totally dismiss the evidence that's in front of your eyes,
right?
Because it just contradicts your beliefs. Yeah.
People that went to the Affordable Care Act website on day one, or people that have spent time in the DMV, believe that there are these vast government-run conspiracies. I'm like, dude, I've worked for the government. They are incompetent as fuck. Like, if you really believe the government is... Look, they're doing it in the open. That's the problem. They're taking your money and then giving it back to you and calling it a fucking gift.
Yeah
motherfucker, yeah, yeah. You took my money and you're giving some back to me, and now, look, well, thanks, man. Appreciate it. You fucking kidding me? We're dumb as shit. I say that a lot, but it is always true.
But I believe in us. Like, I feel like humanity is capable of so much more.
Right.
If we, like, I feel like
it is. So here's the thing. It is capable. I just think that nobody is capable of doing it anymore. And we did a show, was it yesterday, I think, where I was just like, you know, I've kind of given up on the notion that we're all going to come together and be one. And
well, there's a problem with, so the individual person is fine, right? But when you start to group and form and out groups, then all these other psychological, whether it's the bystander effect or cognitive dissonance. So I hate to quote Tommy Lee fucking Jones, although he is he went to Yale, didn't he? Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah.
All good.
Sorry about that. And Men in Black, he says, and I hate to quote Men in Black to you, but he says, a person is smart, people are dumb, panicky, dangerous animals, and you know it, right? So I reference this from time to time, but if you've never looked into the Kitty Genovese thing, the bystander effect study, there's some principle where the more people witness some kind of fucked up event, the less likely anybody is to react to it, right? Mm-hmm. In any kind of helpful way. That's reductive, but it's essentially that. People in large groups, there's so much stuff going on. Like, I don't want to be judged by this person. And a lot of it comes from a good place. Some of it's like, well, I don't want to fucking tell them how to think or step on their toes or anything. But look, that kind of safetyism, which is pervasive through our society now, and it has completely fucked up our education system, is a horrible, horrible thing. Bad ideas do not get exposed in a vacuum. They don't get exposed by censorship. They don't get exposed by shouting or demonizing or catastrophizing or this shit. Bad ideas get exposed by good ideas, right? I don't know what hot feels like unless I felt cold, and vice versa. I don't know what good feels like unless I felt pain. So you have to juxtapose these two things in their own merit. Have that conversation where here's the plan, and it's not the liberal plan or the conservative plan. Here is the plan. Like, imagine there's liberal math or fucking Muslim science. That doesn't make any goddamn sense, nor should it, because you can't, there's no intersectionality with reality. That's just not how it works.
Yeah, I mean, I what I would wish, if I were kind of designing my ideal education system, it would be that kids are taught two skills, critical thinking and kindness.
Right.
And I think those two things together just learn how to think critically about the world. That's why I think poker's such a great game, because it helps you with a lot of those skills, though not always. I mean, there are some very stupid poker players, but that's a different story.
But it's a social meritocracy, though, right? I mean, at the end of the day, the person that played the social game the best is probably going to win, unless there was some kind of
luck. Yeah, the person who thought the best is going to win, for sure.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think critical thinking and kindness taken together are going to, I mean, I hate to say make the world a better place, but they will, because if you kind of approach everything skeptically and critically and analyze it for yourself and know how to do that. You know, how do you actually take this and tease it apart? And if you're kind, and if your first impulse is to be kind to other people and to try to empathize and be understanding and try to figure out, okay, what's going on, rather than jumping to judge right away, I just think the world would be a much better place. Social media probably wouldn't exist, but it would be so much better. I think those are the two most important skills we have.
That's one of the rules of debate. I can't remember the exact phrase, but the general concept is that you should give the person you're arguing with or debating the benefit of the doubt. Take their words in the best possible meaning and not the worst possible meaning right off the face. Because we don't do that. Like if, right, you could see it right now. Cuomo the other day said to, Chris, the guy on CNN, said to Don Lemon, deep down I'm black inside or something like that. That was in context. It was funny. They're clearly friends. Nobody should ever be offended by that. The right was like, if a fucking Republican said that, then blah, blah, blah. And they're right. If a Republican had said that, he would have gotten shredded.
Yep.
There's no question about that. But that has to stand on its own. If it's okay in any sense, it's okay in every sense, right? You have to take this fucking shit out of here. Make your own decisions about how things are going right now.
Yeah.
I would assume you've read The Coddling of the American Mind. It's been out for a while now. That seems like a book that you would have read. There's this phrase that comes up over and over in the book, and it says, prepare your children for the road, not the road for your children, right? So if in your world that you're talking about, people have to be prepared for reality as it exists, right? And what you're talking about is an inoculation to what we've arrived at today. The inoculation is free thought and exchange of information with the underlying empathy, right, attached to it. That should be the case for everybody. If it's not, then you're a piece of shit. Frankly, if you're not trying to think critically and come up with real answers, and you're not doing it from a place where you're trying to help not just yourself but everybody, then you're a fucking piece of shit.
Yep.
Honestly. So stop waving your flag or stop waving your fucking pink hat, whichever side you're on, and shut the fuck up and help people.
There is, I will say though, you know, you give someone the benefit of the doubt at the beginning, right? And take the nicest meaning, and then if they prove you wrong, then that also happens. There's definitely, I'm not saying just be kind to everyone always. Forgive everyone always, but that should be your starting point.
Yeah, it has to be.
That has to be your starting point.
Yeah, I would
you
say.
You can't start off as like a judgmental, I'm right, you're wrong.
Right.
Because you have to start off with an open-minded and open-hearted approach to everything, and then you can figure out, okay, what's real, what's not, you know, which how do I parse this information, how do I take it in context, how do I analyze it. And if you think about kind of classic education with like ancient Greeks, ancient Romans, they taught rhetoric, and that a lot of that was tools of logic, and they
Socratic
taught logic
method, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. They taught critical thinking. Mm. If you think about kind of the decathlon, the 10 topics, so many of those are about how to think critically about the world. And somewhere along the way it became, oh, math and science. And, you know, we need to learn the STEM stuff. And but you also need to learn how to think. And
not what to think, how to think. That's the big difference.
Yeah.
I think that one of the more extreme examples is people that join the military in the United States. So it's an all volunteer service, but we still have very high participation rates compared to other countries that don't have compulsory service. If you ask the average member of the military why they joined, you will hear almost the same thing in different phrasing. I love my family, I love my country, whatever, blah, blah, blah. I don't like bullies comes up a lot, right? And whether or not we perform as bullies on the world stage is another debate to be had. But it seems to come from a baseline of protection, right?
Yeah.
Like that is the purpose of strength, biologically speaking, is to protect. Mm-hmm. The reason that some creatures develop a shell is to protect the inside. The reason we have a rib cage is to protect our heart, right? And our internal organs. The reason that strong people exist in society is not to take advantage of weak people. It is to protect weak people. That's the whole fucking point. And if you're not coming from that perspective, again, you're a piece of shit.
Right.
If you're using your power, strength, or position or privilege to hurt people and not help people, then that's a fucking problem, right? And it's a problem that has to be addressed, whether it's through whether you're a politician, whether you're a criminal, whether you're a fucking a rogue state, it doesn't matter what it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? And we've become far too comfortable with casually labeling people who are kind of minor nuisances or disagree with us to a little bit, maybe, in the grand scheme of things, as the enemy or evil or Hitler or whatever the fuck. It's goddamn ridiculous that we've gotten to this point, man. And I don't know, honestly, I don't know what the way out of any of this stuff is. I would like to hear your thoughts, because clearly you're a very critical thinker. So I would like to hear what you think about how we, like, particularly, you have a very good education at some of the most prestigious universities in the country. But even those Ivy League schools are having very difficult time right now dealing with the internet generation of students coming in that want to be protected from everything. So I don't know how we move forward from this. It is very confusing for me.
Especially with COVID.
No pressure, by the way. Just save the world right quick.
Just save the world. Just save the world for us real quick on the way out of here.
Excellent. Well, honestly, I mean, I think that what we were just talking about is part of the solution for, you know, rewarding people and teaching people how to think through things and giving people time. That's one of the luxuries that we often don't have in this constant environment of social media and, oh my God, can you believe this happened? Outrage, gotta fire right away, gotta do this right away. Give some time to reflect and to cool off. So when I was at Columbia, I studied, my advisor was Walter Mischel, who's well known as the marshmallow guy, the guy who actually created the marshmallow test. I was his last grad student. So everything I was studying was about self-control and how to cool hot stimuli and how to actually take a step back so that you can be critical, because in the moment you can't. It's like poker, being on tilt, right? When you're on tilt, when you're in the hot emotional condition, you can't make a good decision. You can't play well. You can't actually come to the right conclusion because it's too personal and your emotions are in it. And so I feel like one of the big solutions to this is actually looking, having the time to look at context and to figure out, okay, well, what's the punishment here? What was this person intending, to try to understand and approach with empathy and kindness and context? And sometimes the answer is going to be, holy shit, this person's a piece of shit.
Right.
And everything that we've said about them is deserved and then some. That happens. But sometimes it will also happen that you'll be like, oh, this wasn't actually so bad and they didn't mean it. And they, since like, it was a sincere gaffe, or it wasn't even a gaffe, because if you look at the full context, it wasn't at all what you think it was. And then you move forward. And that used to be possible a lot more in the pre-social media age, because I think one of the things that social media has done is create this time pressure and create this public pressure and create this mob mentality, which frankly is the enemy, the antithesis of critical thinking and of being able to think clearly.
Yeah, you can ask Rome about that, by the way, but they don't exist anymore because they allowed there's this old quote from the Roman Senate, and it's at Scipio, a number of people wrote it, but Rome is the mob. That was the quote, right? Good luck, motherfucker, with that bullshit, because as soon as the mob doesn't like you, you're done.
Yeah.
That's first they came for the socialists, right? Like we have to read that and understand the fucking words in front of us.
Yeah, I mean, you have to, I think that's important. And I think it's important to see the world. This is another thing that poker teaches you. See it in shades of gray. You know, the world is not black and white. Yeah, some things are black and white. You know, I'm Jewish, and yes, I do think that, and I've lost family in the Holocaust. Like, that was pretty black and white.
Yeah.
Like, I'm pretty black and white about that. I think that there are lots of, but in general, people are shades of gray, and you need to be willing to look at the world with nuance and not necessarily just stick labels on people. And psychologically, that's what we want to do,
right?
Because it's so much easier.
It's intellectually lazy.
Yeah. But it's so much easier because we don't like, the human brain doesn't like uncertainty. It doesn't like ambiguity. And you know what? That's the world.
But
the world's uncertain. It's probabilistic. Yeah. It's ambiguous. And
it's
we
also
need to learn to deal with it.
It's also easy to go home and order fast food, right?
Yeah.
Every night, instead of cooking good food for yourself. But there's a goddamn consequence to that shit. And we're seeing some of the consequences. Now, I think about Brett Weinstein and what he went through. There was this, it was a national day where underrepresented people, whether it be people of color, gay, trade, whatever it is, we're going to take the day off of school. We're doing a walkout for solidarity, whatever the case is, right? Mm-hmm. For awareness. And I don't know if you're familiar with the story, but it pivoted one year where they were like, you know what? We're going to have a day where white cis people aren't allowed here or whatever the fuck. Right. And he's like, that's probably not a good idea. Like, right. It's one thing for you guys to opt out of the day to celebrate whatever you're celebrating or to bring focus in or whatever, or start a conversation, whatever. But telling people because of how they look that they can't come here, that is where I draw the line. That's kind of fucked up, right?
Right.
So he got shredded for this shit. Yep. He and his wife got fucking shredded for it and eventually, had to leave their positions there. And it's the guy's intent clearly was not to stifle conversation. As a matter of fact, he and his brother are two of the fucking thought leaders in the country right now. And they're certainly not conservatives. They're certainly not anti-LGBTQI, whatever the fuck letters, I can't remember all of them now. They're not anti-people of color, they're not anti-any of this shit. He was coming from a very good place, but because that conversation took place over the course of 3 days and not 3 months or 3 years, then it happened the way it happened and he lost his career over it. It's fucked up, man. And the lesson is, and it was one of the first big cancels, right, mm-hmm. in 2017. The lesson is we, the mob, with our emotional reasoning and our lack of deductive reasoning, can, if we bind ourselves together, influence major shit in this mm-hmm. country. And we saw it again with the fucking GameStop stock, right? I mean,
up again through the moon today. AMC's up.
A big enough group of people with no evidence to support their theory can enact their theory at a national level right now. Yes. That is a fucking problem for everybody, right? And it's not a problem that you can solve through authoritarianism, because that shit always fails. Mm-hmm. It's a problem that has to be solved by teaching people how to think critically. But I will say that universities, governments, businesses have to have a no tolerance policy for this cancel culture bullshit. Otherwise, like, if you feed whatever you feed in life, yourself, your body, or your brain, or whatever it is, or your social groups, whatever it is, whatever you feed, the result is going to be, you know, commensurate with what you fed them. And if you keep feeding these people positive stimulus for acting in a mob way, then they're just going to keep getting more emboldened and continue doing it. And it's mm-hmm. not good for anybody. It's not good for them. That's the problem. People think because it works for me right now, then it works. But that's not the case. You plan for the future, motherfucker. You plan. If I put this tool in the hands of an evil actor, how much damage can they do with it? And how easy is it to stop them from doing it? And right now, somebody that wanted, like, if a foreign country wanted to start an information operation in this country and get the woke crowd all tuned up about something, it wouldn't be that hard to do it. Right?
Right.
That's a problem. We can't be that vulnerable intellectually.
But we are.
Yes.
And that's the simple truth of it. And, you know, I don't know how to correct that. And I don't know how to fix that problem. Obviously, Maria, you were supposed to, and you didn't, clearly.
Yeah, thanks a lot for nothing.
Thanks for nothing, Maria. I feel like you didn't save the world.
Yeah, go spend your $300,000.
on another degree. Totally kidding. This is the point in the show where you get to the drinking bro of the week, which is someone who has inspired you or helped you become the person you are today. This can also be a lady, if you so choose as well. We have a spinoff show called the Drinking Broettes as well, that is with our female co-host. So you can do whatever you want. Who has inspired you and helped you the most?
Well, there are too many people, honestly. Mm-hmm. So we can go all Oscars and start to mm-hmm. thank all the people who've helped me get here. But I think the person that I would love to highlight, well, two people, but one of them who unfortunately is no longer with us is someone who I mentioned earlier on, Walter Michelle, who was my graduate advisor, who was one of the wisest people I'd ever met, and who died before I finished The Biggest Bluff. So I ended up dedicating it to him. But he taught me a lot about the world and how to approach it and how to think about it. And he was a rare person who was in academia and was, you know, one of the greats of psychology of the 20th century. And I was completely honest with him when I went for my PhD and said, I don't want to go into academia. I actually think this is really interesting and I want to learn how to think about it at a high level, but I want to be a writer. And he said, great. Too many people these days are way too focused on just their one thing and they have blinders on. And I think it's amazing. Mm. And I think more people should be like that. Let's do it. And so that's so rare, someone who actually encourages that and who encourages knowledge for the sake of knowledge, who says, you know, if you're interested in psychology and you're good, come study with me. You know, I will share my wisdom with you. And it doesn't matter if you're doing it for any reason other than to understand how to think better and how people think.
Right.
And to me, that's just such an inspiring attitude. I think, especially these days, so much of education and so much of what people choose to do with their time is for a purpose, in the sense of, I will make money with this, or this is good for X career, or this is how it will be useful. You don't know how things are going to be useful. You don't know what life is going to be like. You can't see the future. Mm-hmm. And it's so wonderful to just be free to do things because they interest you and to be curious. Mm-hmm. And he's someone who really, I think, inspired and encouraged me to always be curious. The other person I will say is my mom.
Yeah.
No, seriously, she's a remarkable woman who came here. I mean, I was born in the Soviet Union, back when it was the Soviet Union, came here, got divorced right away, and had no money, was a refugee, basically, from stateless, yeah. a refugee from the Soviet Union, and raised us. She did get remarried, and the person I call my dad is actually my stepdad, and he's absolutely incredible. But originally it was just us, and we had no money. And it's kind of amazing that I grew up poor and I didn't realize it. And that's because she never made us feel poor. She just always supported us, loved us, and there was never this question of, oh, wow, did you realize that all the clothes you're wearing are donations?
Yeah.
And that's amazing. Yeah. And she's one of the strongest women I know.
Well, that's the case for most first generation Americans, frankly.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is grapes, coffee, beans, whatever it is, struggling on the vine produces the best product, right? And it's we're really working hard to remove the struggle from adolescence, and that is I can't imagine a bigger mistake to make for the future of a country, right? Yeah. I mean, it's just like it's like being an athlete and you stop going to the gym, man.
Yeah.
Like what do you think the fucking result's going to be? I'm glad to hear that. That's great. Proud of your mom for doing that. We have a friend who's the same, Kirill. He took a much different path in life, but still very successful. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Still very successful. Yeah.
Absolutely.
From the same area, actually.
Maria, thank you for being here today. Tell everybody where they can find you. Yep.
Thank you guys so much for having me.
Sure.
I am online. I have a website, mariakonnikova.com, that I almost never update, but it exists. I'm on Twitter as M. Konnikova, and I'm on Instagram as girl named Maria, but girl doesn't have an I because somebody already took that handle by the time I got on Instagram. So it's just GRL named Maria. And one day I will convince that person to surrender the Instagram handle girl named Maria with an I to me.
Have you reached out to him yet? I mean, we can strong
arm
him.
No, I haven't.
Yeah,
but I should.
We can strong arm him. Yeah. And if you're going to do
strong
arm the people from Amazon, because they've got you down as a 2-time New York bestseller. Yeah. So have them change it to 3.
Yeah. You want a 3-peat, right?
Yes. Yes. You don't want to be a twosie.
Like, look, a lot of people have won back to back.
Yeah.
Three in a row, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's no doubt. There, you've done it.
Back to back is like the Spurs. Lakers and Bulls.
Yeah,
Lakers and Bulls, right?
Absolutely. Thank you for being here, Maria. For D'Anthony Holloway, I am Ross Patterson. This is the Drinking Bros. Good night, everyone.